The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of Audlin Brown, BD Developments, Stem Cell Technologies, and listeners like you. In June of 2021, Canada, along with the other G7 countries, committed to reaching net zero carbon emissions by 2050. It is an audacious goal, but it's one that affords Canada an opportunity to play a leadership role and become the first of the G7 to reach net zero emissions. Now, it's a long way from where we are at the moment. Currently, says Janet Jackson of Foresight, we're in last place, which, interestingly enough, accelerates our need to step up the pace and position Canada as a force of nature on the path to net zero. Over the past decade, Foresight has worked relentlessly towards making net zero a reality. Foresight has a 10-point approach to accelerate research and development in clean tech, build regional clusters, and host events. Jackson says, "We're creating the ecosystem that fosters investment in world-leading companies that are serving a social purpose, that being achieving net zero by virtue of the products and services that are produced and provided." On February 6th, Foresight is hosting City Age Vancouver, the Urban Zero Challenge. I invited Janet Jackson to join me for a conversation that matters about the opportunities and challenges ahead of us on our path to GHG reduction. Janet, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, what exactly is the Urban Net Zero Challenge? Let's start with that, because that's on its own a great big hairy audacious goal.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at GHG emissions, and there's the industrial considerations, which are often in remote areas with manufacturing and production of our resource sector, for example. But when we start to sort of look at what's happening around communities and urban centers, they too are major opportunities for us to lean in with innovation, business models, investments, and other solutions that help decarbonize these centers. And so different facets include things like transportation, buildings, energy infrastructure, waste management, and water is a pretty unique one as well, because a lot of people don't realize it takes about 20% of energy to clean and move fresh water. And obviously, it's a resource that we all need to survive.
Well, water is a huge infrastructure issue because we, number one, have to deliver clean drinking water, mm-hmm. but we also have a major requirement, a significant requirement, to deal with wastewater and stormwater. Mm-hmm. So all of these become important factors. But does the movement of water not also provide opportunities? Because, you know, I hear more and more about turbines being placed within, mm-hmm. you know, water flow that is producing electricity. Is this something that is going to be on the agenda?
Yeah, I mean, the circularity of systems is a major opportunity for decarbonization. Anytime you can tap into a moving water or even waste hot water, your ability to pull energy from that system is an opportunity to help decarbonize, because then you're not drawing fresh new energy, you know, from the original supply.
There's this company out in Coquitlam. Are you familiar with them? That they use basically waste water heat, mm-hmm. To convert that back into energy, and it's in use right now. Is this the kind of innovative application of what are already in some ways existing technologies?
And that's a great example of what we're seeing with urban environments in terms of, you know, do you lean towards centralized or decentralized energy system? Do you give autonomy to small businesses and other sort of mini communities within the urban center to manage their own energy system so that it's less reliant on the large infrastructure, which, you know, in the face of climate change does face considerations, things like blackouts and brownouts. When temperature went down to, you know, minus 15, minus 50 in, you know,
in regions like Alberta, yeah.
those systems were tapped out. And so the ability to, you know, be able to lean into some distributed energy system so that there's independence when needed, I think is a big opportunity for decarbonization as well.
The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of Audlin Brown, BD Developments, Stem Cell Technologies, and listeners like you. There's a fascinating book called A New Spirit of Capitalism that was put out by the Trilateral Commission a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And what I found fascinating about it was it said, no longer do we want industry just to stand alone and try and figure out what it wants to do. The free market has to work in conjunction with legislators mm-hmm. and identify what the problem is, set the rules, mm-hmm. and you have to stick to them. Because if the rules are constantly changing, you're not going to get the kind of investment in intellectual energy or financing to solve a problem. And it points, in the book, it points to climate. Mm-hmm. If we want to address the challenges that we have highlighted, it's going to be that free market energy and innovation that is actually going to create the solutions, rather than just saying, we're going to leave it up to legislators. Are they right?
I mean, it's definitely a fascinating dynamic. You need regulation to create confidence in the market so that industry will invest. They want to see that through regulation, they're going to have end users or buyers of the products and services, ideally green, you know, that they produce. And to further extrapolate from that, let's look at green cement.
Right.
Right? There are actually a lot of great technologies, carbon cure, you know, CO2 block, all these different companies that are providing solutions to groups in the supply chain, like the Lafarges, like the Lehighs, and they're mm-hmm. going to municipalities and other industry infrastructure developers and saying, look, same price, same performance, 30% less GHG emissions. And yet, because of some policy or regulatory challenges, or it's not, you know, clearly articulated in the requirement specs, that technology or that product isn't being consumed. So I do think there's a critical role for regulators and policy to make. I also think, though, that there's an opportunity for industry to take a look at their P&L and their balance sheet and to think about opportunity cost of things like carbon tax, and start making those investments and leaning in with the adoption of clean tech solutions today, rather than waiting for policy to catch up.
So when we take a look at the urban, you know, net zero challenge, mm-hmm. where does the responsibility for this lie? Is it in individuals, or is it in companies? is it in the city government? Who should be taking the lead?
I mean, in housing and building infrastructure in particular, there's some challenges because right now we have such a shortage of housing infrastructure. There's a want to just build whatever we can as soon as we can and sort of worry about the decarbonization aspects. But the reality is the solutions around sustainability are often, you know, embedded solutions. You got your plumbing, electrical, everything in it. You can do it modular. You can prefab different homes. And even now you can do multiple story buildings that are prefab and things like that. So I think it is the role of government and communities to set the tone on what their ideal outcome is for that, for example, building infrastructure to look like. And then industry's at the table ready to go. I mean, a lot of people still look at technology and innovation in the climate space as being early, early stage. But the reality is over the last 10 years, a lot of these technologies have matured. So in things like buildings, like transportation, like energy infrastructure for communities, it's ready to go now, but we still haven't crossed the gap for some reason on the adoption side. And you need the incentives and you need procured purchasing power to really move the needle.
When you say on the adoption side, are you saying adoption by industry or adoption by average citizens?
It's industry, it has to set the tone. I mean, yeah. Although industry, citizens are a fascinating, complex element to this because even when someone has seen a friend lose a home to a fire or a flood, you still don't see that translate into different purchasing decisions on the ground. And I personally don't think people are concerned or won't be concerned enough until we have food, water, and energy quotas per capita. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people may laugh, and obviously I don't want to be doom and gloom because you want to stay positive. There are solutions out there. We can reach these goals. But unfortunately, consumer behavior doesn't give us the confidence, or me the confidence, that everyone's going to make decisions to buy green all the time, right? There's just not enough knowledge, awareness, and pressure yet.
The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of Audlin Brown, BD Developments, Stem Cell Technologies, and listeners like you. One of the challenges is there may be storm clouds over the horizon, but the average person isn't like looking up enough to go look over the horizon, and they don't see them coming.
Right.
And so then there's an emergency. And when there is an emergency, too often there's a knee-jerk reaction to it. When there are those knee-jerk reactions, does the environment actually win? And I'm not certain that it does, because people then go, but I want this and I want it now. Well, the most expedient way isn't necessarily the most ecologically friendly.
Right. Yeah, and that is, again, further challenge, because people also look at cost, interest rates, inflation, and those types of factors are playing a role in decisions. So I would say 3 years ago, I probably would have said, you know, people are taking the time to maybe assess what other opportunities there are to look at better solutions when it comes to the environment. Today's climate, people are definitely putting things like, okay, can I afford it? How's it, you know, there's uncertainty.
Right.
Any element of uncertainty just adds to what is already an uncertain macroeconomic environment.
Well, take a look at food, for instance. Mm-hmm. When interest rates were lower and per capita GDP was still rising, which is not in Canada any longer, people had the money to be able to say, yeah, I want to know how that food was processed. What is the environmental footprint of that farm? Mm-hmm. And now they're going, it's more important to me, can I afford it?
Yeah.
And so that's going to put a tremendous amount of pressure on so much of what the government is wanting to do to change farming practices, because there's no doubt that as we move towards a greener economy, costs rise.
Yeah. I agree. I had a great call this morning. We have an Agrinext stream, which is all about decarbonizing food production. And it's like, who pays for that? You know, farmers, their margins are not big. There's, you know, the big buyers have often negotiated these 2-3% margin for high volume, you know, deals. And even though they might increase the price on the outside, you know, those farmers are committed. And so who funds that, right? And so that's where groups like Farm Credit Canada and a few others are trying to lean in and figure out what are some of the models on lending and support to help farmers, adopt these solutions. Because it's not just about the environment. I mean, obviously for me, that's where my heart, lies. But it is about productivity. We all want to be able to do more with less. That's what sustainability is.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not only good for the environment, it's good for business to figure out how we can accelerate adoption to improve productivity of some of these critical sectors. I mean, a funny story, there was a major investor that we had brought up from the U.S., and there's big infrastructure opportunities. You've got things like fusion and fission and nuclear and small nuclear. There's big, big ideas happening, carbon capture. And I was talking to him about his investment thesis. And he said, well, one of the technologies we developed or invested in, is it's like a sidebar that goes on to the trucks when they're pulling the, you know, goods from the land. And it saves 20% waste. So what happens is if you don't have these sidebars on the tractors, the food's just flying out and going, you know, as there's 20% loss before you even hit the production facility.
Mm-hmm.
Putting those on, that's 20% added to the bottom line of these farmers, you know, once it filters through all their processing and distribution steps, right? So it's not just about the big things. It's what are some of the problems that we have in the amount of resources that are going into produce that supply, and how can we tap into that from an environmental perspective as well?
Well, I think the advances that are happening in agriculture are extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
I did a fascinating interview with a geneticist, mm-hmm, who said that he was working on helping seeds to take root just a little bit quicker so that they could start to lay down their own root system.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing so, they then attracted a certain kind of bug that sped up growth and increased the total amount of carbon capture from each seed that was planted.
Wow.
So they're looking at this genetic modification as saying, how can we make that plant capture more carbon?
Yeah.
Which it already does. That's the great thing about agriculture, especially when you're growing crops. I mean, you're capturing massive amounts of carbon.
Yeah, no, I think massive opportunities for the ag tech space. And to add to that, it's also things like fertilizers, right? And how are we deploying fertilizer? What type of fertilizer? How does that impact the soil that it rests in, and how do you speed up production responsibly? I remember in social studies many years ago as a student, and we used to talk about crop rotation. Remember the four systems?
That's right.
And that was all to sustain supply to our growing populations. A lot of those practices had been pushed out, right? They just keep using the same land for the same thing, and it depletes. And yet, a lot of it is going back and thinking, okay, how can we look at the practices and the learnings historically that worked and do that at scale, or again, with less inputs.
The production of this program is made possible thanks to the support of Audlin Brown, BD Developments, Stem Cell Technologies, and listeners like you. There's a wonderful gentleman by the name of Murad Al-Khatib, who is in Regina, AGT Terminals.
Mm-hmm.
And for 20 years now, he's gone around to farmers and said, when you have a crop that's going to lay fallow, plant pulses.
Mm.
Because pulses affix nitrogen back into the soil. And he says, and I will buy your crop. He's created a $2 billion a year industry. He's helping farmers, and most importantly, he's helping to rejuvenate and maintain the health of these crops. This is innovative thinking.
Yeah.
So there's a little bit off of coming back to like
urban centers.
In the workshop or the event that you're holding, what's the day look like, and what are you hoping the outcomes will be?
Yeah, I mean, usually for us, we always partner with events. So CityAge is a great partner for these conversations. We always like to start with macroeconomic trends. You know, what's the state of the land right now? Where are we at, really, when it comes to reaching our net zero targets? What are some things that are working?
Mm-hmm.
And let's celebrate those wins. It's always important to make sure we lean in where things are working. And so we want to reinforce that narrative with the audience. And then we have an honest conversation about where some of the problems are.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, when it comes to urban environments, looking at the buildings, the transportation infrastructure, water, waste management, we're going to be focusing some of our conversations around the built environment and our clean tech adoption platform. So in terms of the built environment, a third of GHG emissions come from urban centers and often relate back to the built environment. I'm seeing still new homes, for example, be built without proper insulation.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a call from my friend, I can't believe I just bought this house and we had it renovated and I'm still getting a breeze through my head, right? Like these things, it's so,
right.
Just even reinforcing that there are solutions available in the built environment. But then what's the forward-looking adoption look like? So for us, it's about innovation challenges and mapping out what regulatory opportunities are available to help drive adoption of made in Canada, ready to go building technologies.
So based on that rundown, what is the current state from your perspective?
In buildings or broadly?
Broadly, yeah. As far as our ability to meet this net zero challenge, where are we at?
I mean, I have concerns. I think, in Canada, we've done a tremendous job on the supply side of solutions. So not just innovation, but the business models and the supply chain, pressure to adopt solutions. However, on the adoption side, we're still not seeing, not just in Canada, but globally, because 90% of Canadian clean tech companies export as well, right? But we need to see a more accelerated adoption of solutions. And in the last couple of years, with inflation and interest rates and other economic pressures, we've seen it slow down. So I'm nervous. I'm always hopeful. But I think we need to get a little bit more alignment on where money is being spent to drive adoption of solutions? What are some of those triggers and carrots that we can put out that make sense for a broader base of adopters?
So is our biggest challenge technological, or is it cost of living?
It depends. I think in terms of technology, if you look across sort of there's a technology readiness level curve, 1 to 9, right?
Yeah.
1 being it's an idea,
right.
9 to 11 being like we're on our way,
right.
Full adoption. A lot of sectors have seen maturity in their supply chain or the technologies mm-hmm. that can reimagine their supply chain. So things like buildings, there's some mature technologies. Energy, a lot around, digital and moderating and moving energy. Now that has become much more efficient in transportation. Obviously, we know electrification, hydrogen is trying to catch up in certain markets. So I hate to say it depends.
Yeah.
I think there is a strong number of technology streams that have ready-to-go solutions, both in their technology readiness and their business model. And then we're constantly going to need to figure out who is the next group we lean in to help them succeed.
Are you familiar with the work of Walter Merida out at UBC?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, I went, oh my gosh, that is innovative. Show up in the morning with your electric car, we'll pay you to park,
yeah.
You plug your car in, and we'll borrow that energy from your car to ignite the grid to begin with,
yeah.
Generate new electricity during the day, recharge your car, but use the excess of the energy that we've created to produce green hydrogen. That can be used in delivery vehicles and so on.
Yeah.
To me, I go, that's the kind of innovative thinking that we need because we can deliver it.
Well, and it's very holistic. Walter yeah. is incredibly progressive in saying, okay, we've got this silo over here on electrification. You got these, and then you've
yeah.
got the need for green hydrogen here. How do we look at these systems with a more integrated approach? And I think that's definitely an opportunity that Walter's taking. We at Foresight mm-hmm. are taking that same approach as well. Instead of supporting one company who can provide a solution, we're saying, okay, let's look at a cohort of companies
right.
across a supply chain and help them come together to provide the market with a turnkey solution so that the market can more easily understand, okay, if I make this investment, it's not just a piece of it, it's going to get me to a certain point. Now, net zero by 2050, we're hoping earlier. Germany wants to get there by 2045. And so that at Foresight, our goal is the first. So we got to get ahead of that. But that holistic ecosystem, assessment and approach is critical.
Well, I'm going to run out of time here, but the other thing that I like about green hydrogen mm-hmm. is it blends beautifully with diesel, gasoline, and natural gas, and when you do so, you immediately drop the carbon footprint of all three of those fuels. There's an innovative way in which things can be integrated in the transition because it's going to take time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, right? There's big challenges ahead, and I think the more we can work together and collaborate, making sure for us, we want to make sure we're aware of what Walter's working on so we can supply technologies. And there's a lot of cool people across the country that, have committed their life to figuring out how these systems can work and be more efficient. And so collaboration and leaning in is certainly what we need to do to see that path come to fruition.
Couldn't agree more. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and please visit conversationsthatmatter.ca and become a subscriber. And thank you to Audlin Brown, BD Developments, and Stem Cell Technologies for their support.